Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, Garrison Keillor explores the secret life of Mark Twain.
So you get to see how poor Mark Twain's first draft was and how little improvement he made in it with all of his excisions. It's a very strange book.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. The Times' Bill Carter guides us through the late-night talk show wars.
They had Conan O'Brien doing well at 12:30, and he hosted the Emmy Awards, and he started to get really hot. And they thought, oh, we're going to lose him to another network the way we lost Letterman.
And Jennifer Schussler has bestseller news. All that after this break.
The New York Times Book Review Podcast is brought to you by Ford and Voice Activated Sync, the in-car connectivity system that features 911 Assist to give you peace of mind. And by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature.
The Mark Twain industry marches on. There's a new book, a surprise bestseller. It's called Autobiography of Mark Twain, Volume 1. It's reviewed on our cover by America's perhaps greatest and most beloved humorist, R. Mark Twain, the great Garrison Keillor. So, Garrison, of course, it's a privilege to have you here. A little intimidating because you are a master of this medium. But I'm going to quote one of many hilarious sentences in your review and ask you what you mean by it. You say, here is a powerful argument for writers burning their papers. You'd like to be remembered for The Innocents Abroad and Life on the Mississippi and the first two-thirds of Adventures of Huckleberry Finn and not for excruciating passages such as one finds in this book. Is this book actually kind of hard to get through?
Nobody is going to read this book from cover to cover. Nobody. Absolutely nobody. It just is a big bushel basket full of odds and ends, and I couldn't figure it out where the schematic came from. They claim to be working on Twain's directions, but I don't know how they got them. It includes odd things like his rough draft of a piece of book, whatever it was, on Joan of Arc with crossouts, the crossouts included, every crossout. So you get to see how poor Mark Twain's first draft was and how little improvement he made in it with all of his excisions. It's a very strange book. This is going to be one of the great unread classics. Parts of it are classic. And the rest, people are going to be paging through this.
Does it show us, or you, did it show you a side of Twain you hadn't seen before, or perhaps not as fully exposed as one finds here?
Yes, it shows me a part of Twain I didn't want to see, which is that in his old age, when he did most of his work on the autobiography, the actual autobiography, not this collection of odds and ends, he needed an editor. He was all over the place. And there are little flashes of Mark Twain. And then there are long stretches of an old man doddering along, which I really didn't want to see.
One always hesitates to speculate about the motives or impulses of readers. But why do you imagine this book is so successful now? It's selling tremendous numbers of copies. A publisher can't keep up with the demand.
People love Mark Twain. He's still funny all these years later, and people love to quote him. And he has a great brand name, which he himself promoted in his lifetime, and good for him. But this is not the Mark Twain that people think they're going to get.
How much influence did he have on your work? Were you a Mark Twain guy from an early age?
I read Mark Twain, but I read him for fun when I was a boy. I had a hard time learning to read, and so when I finally did learn to read, I really went at it. And I read Mark Twain, I think, about the same time I read Sinclair Lewis. I read a whole batch of his stuff in the seventh grade, as soon as I got up into junior high and into a big library. And I read Huckleberry Finn first and then Tom Sawyer and The Prince and the Pauper just because they were boys' books. I had no idea they were great literature or that Huckleberry Finn was great literature. Nobody had pointed this out to me. So I read them purely for fun, and they were great fun. I laughed out loud at a lot of Huckleberry Finn.
Did you laugh out loud much reading this book?
This book?
This new one.
No, I'm afraid not. I felt more and more umbrage on behalf of a great American writer for including stuff I don't think he would have wanted in there.
Thanks a lot, Garrison Keillor.
Thank you, Sam Tannenhaus.
It's Garrison Keillor, the great Garrison Keillor, who this week reviews Autobiography of Mark Twain on the cover of the New York Times Book Review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
Stieg Larsson, the gift who won't stop giving. What's going on now?
Well, Stieg Larsson's longtime companion, Eva Gabrielsson, who lived with him for 30 years until he died in 2004 at the age of 50, is now coming out with her own book. It's a memoir, and it'll come out in late June of next year in English. And apparently she's going to describe her life with Stieg Larsson when he was writing his Millennium series, the books that have been a huge runaway bestseller across the world, starting with The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. And this book, we're not exactly sure what's going to be in it, but she's going to talk about how the books came together, and she says that she's going to reveal some things that will be of great interest to Larsson fans.
Now, Julie, I assume this is not the same publisher, Alfred A. Knopf, that has been doing the very successful crime series.
It is not. This is going to be published by Seven Stories Press. It's going to be translated from Swedish into English, so I think that this will actually start, the press will actually start going much earlier because it's going to come out in either January or February in Swedish. So presumably someone will be doing their own translation for the English-speaking readers who will be very interested to hear what's in this book. So we may not have to wait until June to find out what Eva Gabrielsson has to say.
Now, there's a lot of controversy involving Larsson's enormous estate, and Gabrielsson's involved in it. Is she a public figure in Sweden? Is she famous?
Yes, she's very well known in Sweden, and there's a great deal of public sympathy for her because there is no common law marriage in Sweden. So when Larsson died, she got nothing, and his estate went to his father and his brother. So they have now taken control over his literary estate, his books. And there is the fourth book, which is of great interest to people who love these books. And Eva Gabrielsson says that she has the partial manuscript to this fourth book on a laptop that was in their apartment. And she says that she hopes it will never be published, but we don't know if that will happen.
So the Swedes were always told are the model for the kind of democracy and society we should become do not recognize common law marriage?
That's right.
I never would have guessed. Thank you, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
Coming up, it's Jay versus Conan. Bill Carter leads us through the late night talk show wars.
The Book Review Podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. For listeners of this podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. One audiobook to consider is The Mind's Eye by Oliver Sacks. After a tumor affects his vision, physician Sacks sets out to share the incredible stories of six individuals struggling with life changes that follow neurological damage. Engaging and poignant. That's The Mind's Eye, available from Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookreview.
Well, the late night follies, we can't get enough of them, and nobody knows more about them than the Times' own Bill Carter. He's got a new book. It's called The War for Late Night: When Leno Went Early and Television Went Crazy. It's reviewed for us by Howard Hampton, who says Carter's entertaining, politely incredulous book is even-handed and flabbergasted when taking in this riotous ugliness. He is fair to most everyone while half disbelieving how it all happened. Delighted that Bill Carter's here to tell us how it all happened.
Well, I'm delighted to be here.
So what went on with this? It was sort of crazy, but the entire nation was following it.
Yeah,
why?
Because if for whatever reason, late-night television people identify with, they get to know these guys in a personal way. They're there in their homes every night, in their bedrooms. I think that's another factor. And they sort of like, you know, follow their backstage actions more than they do other performers, it seems like, because I think they talk about it on the air. You know, if Letterman gets in a sex scandal, he has to address it on the air. If Leno's being fired, he tells everybody on the air.
And so how did all this happen? You have this hugely successful program. Leno is destroying the competition
right.
night after night. So what went on here?
It was overthinking. They had Conan O'Brien doing well at 12:30, and he hosted the Emmy Awards, and he started to get really hot. And they thought, oh, we're going to lose him to another network the way we lost Letterman. So we can't have that happen. Let's prevent that from happening. We'll guarantee Conan the show, but only in 5 years. And Jay will have five more years. And thinking, well, Jay will get old, and he'll fade away by then. But that didn't happen. So the 5 years went by, and now they faced a crisis.
And they came up with a very unusual, if not bizarre, solution.
Yes. The bizarre solution was, well, we'll keep Jay, but we'll move him to prime time. We'll put him on at 10 o'clock, five nights a week, doing a comedy show, five nights a week. Not the Tonight Show, but a comedy show, which overestimated Jay's talent and really was impossible for almost any performer. Even like Jackie Gleason couldn't do a five-night-a-week comedy show or a big, big comedy performer from the past.
Okay, so why does Jay Leno, the king of late-night television, agree to do this?
That's a really good question, and part of it is that he was just reluctant to move on. He had a big offer from ABC and could have left and stayed in late-night on ABC. But he has this – he's a creature of habit, and he didn't want to go to another network and see that the attacks that – he felt would come on for leaving, for abandoning his network. He thought that he'd be, like, criticized for that. And he's really sensitive to what happened to him with Letterman the last time. He thought he took such bad press that he was looking to avoid that. Instead, it collapsed on him even worse.
Okay, so we've talked about Leno. What about Conan?
Well, why did Conan do it? Conan wanted The Tonight Show more than anything. He wanted The Tonight Show like these older guys did, which surprised me because he's a younger guy. And I feel like his audience doesn't even know who Johnny Carson is. But he used to watch Carson with his father. He used to tell that story. He'd be 12 years old in Brookline, Massachusetts, watching the show with his dad. And the idea that he could someday host that show was just too much for him. He had to go for it.
But this idea of following Leno, he knew would be trouble.
Yes, and he didn't know that. When he agreed, he assumed Jay was leaving. And when they came to him and said Jay was going to be on at 10 o'clock, he was poleaxed by that. He thought, this isn't what I signed up for. I signed up for a free crack. I'm going to be behind this guy again. And that really started his frustration, which I think continued throughout the whole time he did have The Tonight Show, that he was behind Leno and he blamed his bad ratings constantly on the fact that Jay was on ahead of him and doing poorly, whereas really he had already fallen behind David Letterman before Jay even went on the air.
So what's the state of play now? Do these guys like each other and hate each other? Are they friends?
Jay never hates anybody. He tries to make friends with everybody. He doesn't like being disliked. So he tries, if he could, he would make up with Conan tomorrow. But Conan won't speak to Jay, I don't think, ever again. He has a real strong dislike of Jay Leno right now because he feels like Jay broke his promise. Jay said he was going to give up the show and went back to the show. So there's real bitterness on the Conan side, no question about it. And then he's moved on to cable. And he's doing, I think, a more inventive show on cable, more in his style than he did on The Tonight Show. I don't think he really was the right style for The Tonight Show in a lot of ways. But I think he's freer now, and I think – but we don't know how it's going to do. It started out well. Jay has come back into first place in late night. Conan does very well with younger people, which is going to mean a lot down the road because he's, the older audience will eventually die off. But Conan, he'll do fine, I think, but he's not going to be – the guy that he wanted to be, which was, Mr. Late Night.
Bill, you've mentioned audiences. What role today does the late night talk show have in our culture? Johnny Carson was the lodestar. Everybody from Kenneth Tynan to Dick Cavett, who's got a new book out, says, this guy was the maestro. He's the best there ever was.
Yeah.
No one will ever be as good. Is it even possible for somebody to do what Johnny Carson
did? It's not, because there's just no way one guy can dominate. I mean, there are now 7 or 8 or 9 of these guys. I mean, if you really want to know who the big late-night star is now, it's Jon Stewart. Because Jon Stewart gets all the attention. He gets most of the press. He wins all the awards. He's even hosted the Oscars twice. That's what Johnny did.
Mm-hmm.
And Stewart doesn't have nearly as big an audience as Johnny or any of these guys have now on the networks. But the audience is just divided. It's split up. It's different. You can't be a dominant guy. The guests go on all the shows now. You don't have like only so-and-so. I mean, Clinton's been everywhere now, but also Obama has
He made the rounds.
Obama has been on Letterman, Leno, and Stewart now.
So has there ever been any talk of trying to anoint Jon Stewart on primetime television, one of the big three, as
I think I think if something happened to Letterman right now, for example, CBS might consider Stewart, but he'll never do that now. Why should he? Why should he change it now? He's done just as well as he could possibly do being on cable. He doesn't need that. The guy that I think is interesting to look at is Stephen Colbert.
Hmm.
Colbert is a very talented guy, and he's on after Jon Stewart, and he's fine with that for now. But again, this is a guy in second position. You got to look at those guys. They usually want to move up. It's like being in the minor leagues. You want to play in the big leagues. I think he might be a guy to look at to for one of these 11:30 shows in the future.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
Great.
That's Bill Carter, whose new book, The War for Late Night, is reviewed in this week's Book Review.
The Book Review Podcast is brought to you by Ford and Voice Activated Sync, the in-car connectivity system that features 911 Assist. If your airbag deploys, Sync automatically calls 911 using your cell phone and puts you in contact with a 911 operator. Sync will even deliver an urgent message to the operator if you cannot respond. That's peace of mind made possible by Sync. Sync is subscription-free, and it's available exclusively on Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury vehicles. For more details, visit SyncMyRidePodcast.com.
Jennifer Schussler's here with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the almost Christmas list this week?
Big news, Tom Clancy is back.
I missed him.
You did. So did I. So did everybody, apparently. He enters at number one with his latest thriller. It's called Dead or Alive, and it features a bunch of his characters from previous books who come back as a crack intelligence unit tracking a vicious terrorist called, wait for it, the Emir.
Whoa.
Yep. That, kind of surprisingly, is the only new book on either the hardcover fiction or nonfiction list this week. Just like last week, one new book, and it's at number one on the fiction list. Other interesting thing on the fiction list, Jonathan Franzen pops way up to number six. He was down at 14 last week. This is entirely thanks to Oprah. It's the post-Oprah glow, but otherwise sort of same old, same old.
Let's do nonfiction.
Nonfiction. Change of subject. No new books on the list. George W. Bush still at number one with Decision Points. Sarah Palin still dropping her second book, America by Heart. Entered at number two, dropped to number six last week. This week, it's at number eight. And her publisher, it was recently reported that her publisher was not going back to press. The initial print run was about 1 million books. So, you know, you could say her sales are sluggish, but that's really only by Palin standards.
But, Jenny, George W. Bush is really doing well. Do we have any idea why? Is this a big Christmas book for Republicans?
I would guess so. You know, I mean, this is a book by a former president who was in office for 8 years. Sure, he left with extremely low approval numbers. You know, he's sold more than 1 million books. So I think every week all you need is 50 to 100,000 Republican grandfathers or uncles who don't need to get another tie for Christmas this year.
And we have a pretty tough, though amusing, review by Michael Kinsley. Do you think that's going to make any difference?
I don't know. Depends on how much people care about what we think. Mark Twain is still going strong, though. His autobiography is at number three. It was at number two last week. You know, hundreds of thousands of copies. This is a big coup for University of California Press. I don't think they've had a close to number one bestseller in a really long time, if ever. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see if Garrison Keillor's wax at the book this week in our cover review will have any effect on sales.
He's pretty tough on it, isn't he?
He is, but, you know, Twain does have some other fans in high places, including among other best-selling authors this week. Justin Halpern, the author of Stuff My Dad Says, is buying the book for his dad. This week in my column, I wrote about books that a bunch of authors who have current bestsellers, what they're giving as Christmas gifts this year. And Halpern said he is giving his dad Mark Twain's autobiography. And this is what he said to me. I can remember several times in my life when he read something of mine and said, it's not Twain, but it's pretty good. It's exciting to be able to give him something from Twain he hasn't already read five times over. Of course, Garrison Keillor says, in fact, we have already read this book about five times.
Thanks a lot, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.